Yo, what is going down? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the thing!
That's all there needs to be said.
I am Austin Hayden Smith, and I'm joined with the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Raymond.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
And Ryan.
Sup, film fans?
And this week we are rounding out our brief little John Carpenter retrospective. We have done John Carpenter films. Now this will be the fourth film in a row. We started with Big Trouble in Little China. Then we did The Fog. Then we did Escape from New York. And today we're going to be doing probably his most lauded film, his most known film. Although recently people have been talking about They Live more and more. But this is the one that kind of has, I think, stood the test of time as his most classic. We're talking about the 1982 instant classic, The Thing, starring Kurt Russell, Wilford Brimley, T.K. Carter, and a whole host of awesome supporting cast members, as well as some amazing dog actors.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Best animal performance in history.
Dude, it's dude, so the dog is amazing. The first dog is absolutely amazing. And it's based off of the 1938 novel Who Goes There, which is a sort of invasion of the body snatchers type of plot. And then, of course, there was a 1951 version that a lot of people believe is just replete with McCarthyite suspicions about communism infiltrating America. So we can talk about what this film means. Is he trying to emulate certain political things, or is he making sort of just a really fun monster invasion of the bodies type of movie? So what we'll do is first is we'll go around and get some first impressions. What was it like the first time you saw it? How many times have you seen it? Do you love this film? Where does it rank in Carpenter's filmography for you? And then what was it like revisiting this time around? Let's start with Raymond.
I've seen this movie too many times to count. This is my favorite John Carpenter movie, one of my favorite horror movies, one of my favorite movies in general, and it's the fucking best. It's so good. I don't know why we watch anything else. Man, I was so hyped up after this rewatch. I was so excited to get on online and talk about it with you guys. So I think this will be a fun discussion. We had a great time with Escape from New York. I think all three of us agreed that was a lot of fun. And I imagine this will just be to the nth degree. If you don't like this movie, you're wrong.
All right, Ryan?
Man, yeah, I can't say enough good stuff about the movie. The first time I saw it, I was floored. I was legitimately freaked out, too. there's moments, obviously, the famous money shot is when they're doing the defibrillator thing, and then he just goes straight through the guy's stomach and it bites his hands off. That moment I'll never forget watching. And then it crawls away like a little spider thing with a head on it. It's just like, what the fuck? The effects are still hold up to this day, are so scary and incredible. So shout out to the effects team. And then, yeah, this rewatch, I've seen it a bunch of times, too, and it never gets old. Just I love the conceit of the film, the whole paranoia aspect. They're up in Antarctica, which we can get into about what he's going for there. Just a little history on the film and stuff, if you don't know. Like, this is John Carpenter's favorite movie he ever made. It's his personal favorite of his own. This was, and then he always cites the original Howard Hawks version as a inspiration from him growing up. So that's kind of cool that he got to make it, because he wasn't originally supposed to direct the movie either. It was supposed to be Tobe Hooper, the Poultry Guy's Texas Chainsaw Massacre filmmaker. So it's cool that he got to make this. I love Tobe Hooper, but I think that John Carpenter was the perfect guy to make this movie. Also, this was his first movie he didn't score himself, which is a big deal, because his scores are obviously some of the highlights of his movies. But this one he got, if you don't score the movie yourself and you're a badass at it, who do you get? Who's the second best person? Ennio Morricone, of course, from Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and stuff. So then, I love Ennio Morricone's score. This movie's just amazing. Can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah, so I hadn't seen this movie again since I was like a kid. So I was really excited. I mean, I've read synopses about the film, and I've seen film essays, and I've talked to friends, so I feel like I've revisited the film so many times in my imagination or through the eyes of other people. But this was the first time that I've just sat down and watched it, and in decades, I guess you could say. And it was truly, truly remarkable. And I was even scared, like, now, and creeped out now. Like not as a kid, right? But you know, as a dude in his mid-30s watching this film, and I watched it in a cafe with my noise canceling headphones on. And it was
the perfect spot to watch it.
Dude, yeah, I was like,
you really got enraptured.
I'm really good. I work in cafes, so I'm so used to blocking everything out. So like I was like, is it not, I was like creeped out, and I was like, oh my God, this environment is really freaky and weird. It made my skin crawl from the very beginning. It wasn't just the guy getting his hands bit off because of the defibrillator. It was from the beginning. The body horror is really creepy, but also fascinating. You know, like I'm one of those dudes that enjoys watching those YouTube videos about like gross toenails and cysts and bad like ingrown hairs and shit like that. I'm fascinated by it, right? And so the body horror stuff was gross but fascinating and creepy all at the same time. And I think it'll be really interesting to talk about why this film is successful versus a film like maybe The Fog was not as successful. In our estimation, Raymond might disagree, but what is it? What is it about something like The Thing? What is it? What are the elements that come together in the chemistry that make this such a freaking fantastic, moody, but also really interesting narrative, whole kind of cinematic experience? I think that's going to be kind of really fun to explore. So it really is fantastic. And I always think it's worth revisiting or visiting the classics, because you can sometimes forget like why they're a classic, and you might even start to think, oh, it's a classic because everybody says it's a classic. But no, sometimes it's important to revisit these things. Like I just revisited Jaws recently a few months back, and I was like, oh shoot, this is actually a fantastic film, right? And it's the same sort of thing here. It's kind of good to visit these films and be reminded of what great filmmaking is and why it's a classic. It's not just a classic because a bunch of dudes in the previous generation wrote about it and said it was. There's something masterful about it. So let's get into a quick recap, and then we'll kind of start pulling apart this masterpiece and see if we can unlock the key of what makes something a masterpiece. All right, so the film opens in Antarctica with a Norwegian helicopter tracking a running sled dog through the snow, shooting bullets at it. The dog leads the chopper to an American research base, at which point the pilot lands, exits the helicopter, shoots the dog, hitting one of the Americans, while the passenger of the helicopter drops a grenade, blows himself and the chopper up, leaving the Americans kind of confused as to what the heck was just going on. So American pilot R.J. McCready and Dr. Copper, they take off to investigate the Norwegian base to basically check out what the deal was. While they're at the base, they find a malformed humanoid figure, so they decide to bring it back to the American base and do a little investigation on it. While doing the autopsy, biologist Blair finds that there are actually normal human organisms inside this strange humanoid figure. Later, the dog that was being chased through the snow is wandering around the base and is then locked up inside the cage with the other dogs in a sort of like communal kennel. But the dog then starts to metamorphosize and infects all of these other dogs, turning them into these weird hybrid creatures. The crew then have to kill all the infected dogs and incinerate their bodies, and they then learn that what is happening is that there's some organism that is infecting hosts and transforming their cells so that they become perfect replicas of the former bodies. Now, after recovering some data from the Norwegians, the American team, they discover an excavation site with a buried alien spacecraft. So Blair begins to kind of grow suspicious at this, that maybe an invasion is underway and that all life on Earth will be destroyed within a few years. So the organism then starts to make its way through the crew, leading to suspicion and paranoia about who this thing is and who is still human. They devise a blood test to see if they might be able to decipher, but the plan gets scuppered. So with no seeming hope, paranoia and infection having reached a fever pitch and bodies are being burned left and right, McCready and the others decide to blow up the entire station. But as they set the explosives, one of the men transforms into a massive thing creature. And Mac flips the switch, blows up the whole damn thing, station, creature, and everything. And as Mac is sitting there, Childs appears, one of the other American crew members at the station, saying that he got lost in the storm, but they eye each other with suspicion, not knowing if the other is human or thing. And the film closes with Childs drinking whiskey, or maybe gasoline if you investigate the online debate forums, and Mac slightly chuckling. Is he chuckling about the futility of it all, that he knows that Childs is the thing, or that he himself is the thing, that they're both the thing? it leaves you with an ambiguous ending, and that is why there's just tons of theories out there and think pieces that are written about what the hell is going on, what is the thing, etc., etc. End of film. That is John Carpenter's The Thing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right. So, I guess first things first, what is there something in particular that stuck out for you that you feel like this is something that needs to be discussed? Is this a thing that everybody talks about? Like, do you want to talk about the ambiguous ending? Do you want to talk about what the thing is? Do you want to talk about, are there themes? Is this like investigating similar McCarthyite era concerns about paranoia, suspicion? Is there something interesting about how it's America versus Norway at the beginning? Is there a sort of like nationalistic undercurrent here? Is this post-Reagan? Or is this just a badass monster film and we just want to talk about how to make a really good Invasion of the Body Snatchers type of film? What do you guys want to start with?
Two things.
Okay.
For one, back to the effects real quick. The person I think who needs a big shout out is Rob Bottin,
Rob
Stan
Bottin.
Baker's assistant. How do you pronounce it? Bottin? But
Rob Bottin, yeah.
Bottin, okay. And apparently, yeah, he's the one responsible for a lot of the awesome, gross, insane thing effects. And apparently he checked himself into the hospital for exhaustion after the film.
Wow.
Because it was so intense to make. So shout out to him. In terms of what the thing is, I think that's a good place to start.
Cool.
You know, the original Howard Hawks one, like you had mentioned, a lot of people attributed that it's like Cold War, Red Scare kind of paranoia. And then a lot of people talk about with this one, since it's closer to the... What? When did this movie come out? 82?
Yeah.
Or something like that? That it is a metaphor for the AIDS epidemic, right? Where the paranoia kind of, or just, who has AIDS, right? And kind of the whole sexual revolution of that time, but like the paranoia side, the dark side of that. And John Carpenter, I think, has alluded to the fact that, you know, he sees that in the film as well. I don't know if, you know, he was thinking that as... every step of the way as who's directing it. But I think that's a, what do you guys think?
Well, I feel like, wouldn't this be a little early for the AIDS paranoia, or was it like, I don't know, was 80 the early 80s? I thought it was more like mid to late 80s and then into the early 90s, but maybe I'm just misremembering because that was when I was a child.
Raymond, I don't know.
Oh, I don't know offhand when the AIDS epidemic started. I know that the coverage surrounding it started in the late 80s. That's kind
that's
of
what I was
started
yeah.
Becoming more and more of an issue because of the lack of any kind of government response to it. No, I would have to look into a history of that epidemic. I haven't read anything about John Carpenter saying that explicitly, but if you maybe read an interview with him on that, Ryan, then I would take him at his word.
Well, what do y'all think the thing is?
Well, it is interesting that we can. It is interesting that it is a nondescript, indiscriminate organism that is sort of this decentralized rhizome, like a virus. And I couldn't help but think about our own scenario now in a world where a pandemic has ravaged bodies all around the world in an indiscriminate, decentralized fashion. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting is is, and there's a lot of philosophers and political theorists and journalists who have written about this with regards to the paranoia of how we treat other people. You know, it's like when you sneeze in public now, it's like committing a great sin, right? Because everybody, all eyes look to you as you're the infected, so to speak, right? But it creates this process of like othering, where is there a paranoia where you're outside, where you're constantly looking outward from like this body that you believe is this pure body, outward at these potential carriers of this virus, right? And does that create a certain enmity because we are objectifying the other, turning them into some sort of object of fear or object of suspicion? And does that create a sort of paranoiac social set of relationships? And then simultaneously, if you are somebody that is exhibiting symptoms, for example, then it's kind of like, do you have a responsibility to like check yourself? And like, how would you even know? Like, if you were just starting to be taken over by the thing in the Carpenter film, right? Like, what would you do? Of course, you've got maybe a little bit of your consciousness left, but then you've got the consciousness of the thing that is just driving you forward and impelling you to replicate. So it's kind of like there's some interesting things here going on about human responsibility, human agency, as well as the paranoia and all these other things that I think are so interesting to explore. Yeah.
That's one of the really cool things in this movie that the thing and its entire sort of modus operandi, or however it works, it's different in subtle ways from the book. Like, if you read the book, it is much more just like a virus. You don't get a sense that it has like an agenda or anything other than to just propagate and survive. But in the movie, I love those scenes where they are all playing these kind of layers of, okay, if this person is the thing, then it wants to be able to hide. And if it wants to hide, what it's going to do is, there's that scene where he's torching all the blood samples, and the guy who's sort of the red herring, Clark, who spends all the time with the dogs. He comes up and says, no, let's trust MacReady. He knows what he's talking about. Let's trust the process and blah, blah, blah. And that almost makes Mac more suspicious of him, just because everyone else is freaking out the way that, you know, he suspects humans would. And the fact that he steps forward and goes, no, it's okay. Well, I trust you. Let's do things your way. And there is this sense that even though that ends up being, once again, that ends up being a red herring, you do get the sense in this movie that the thing is a lot more smart about how it chooses its moments. Whereas if you read the novella, there are a ton of scenes where they just, like, in the very beginning, they walk into the hallway and the thing has transformed into a big alien just because that's the best form it can take to fight off the dogs. Like, it's a lot less subtle. It's 1A and 1B. I think there are interesting things about either approach, but I really, really like the subtlety in this movie, how they kind of have to, like, play chess with each other, you know? Obviously, they kind of hit that nail on the head in the first scene where they show Mac playing against the computer. But I love those subtle little aspects of it, where they're playing the thing, playing them, trying to put everyone else at ease.
Well, but here's the thing: is we only ever get the angle from
what? Here's the thing.
Here's the thing: we only ever get the perspective or the angle from the human, right? So all of it is interpretation. It could be very well bad interpretation. Like, maybe the thing is just simply trying to survive in its own right, right? Maybe it is just a sort of like indiscriminate, non-agential entity, right? That is trying to just simply find a fucking host to survive. But
and
yet
we
view it
agency to it because we're watching a horror movie.
Yeah, and because it's the way that it survives necessarily means the destruction of flesh. That then it's like, okay, therefore it is evil, right? It is some sort of bad agent. It's the bad guy. But, like, this is the problem of encountering the other, something that you can't speak with, something that you can't encounter, something you can't understand. We just simply can't understand what's going on, man. It's just a little virus trying to do its thing and make it do you,
the
virus.
The thing did nothing wrong. That's what I've been trying to say the whole time. Just like Thanos and Avengers. I know exactly what you mean. Yes, the thing, it's just, I mean, we're trying to kill the thing. It's just trying to survive. What's wrong with us? We're murderers.
That's right. Come on, man. Yeah, you know, and maybe it's like hybrid. It's hybridizing. Maybe you still endure as your cells are replicated, but in a higher state, in a higher form. It just looks violent and gross to us on the outside because it's changing your body for a minute. You don't know, man.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, that is beautiful.
I agree.
That is kind of the question at the end. Not the only question at the end of this, but I do wonder coming away from it what the world would look like if the thing assimilated every living organism in the 27,000 hours.
It'd be just the best.
Yeah, it would be just one hive mind. Like, I am curious.
This blob of people. Like, yeah, the size of, you know, like, the Empire State Building.
So often in science fiction, the sort of notion of the alien invader is all about, like, well, they've exhausted their planet and they've come to take our resources. Or in War of the Worlds, they harvest humans to
it's an imperial
interpretation. Fuel their machines and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wonder what is the thing's game? Or is it, like you said, there's a pretty good chance it might just be a virus. And it's not aware of these people in any way. And it just, you know, its only instinct is to survive. In the book, they say that, like, or they hypothesize that the only reason it turned into a dog was that was the only thing it knew how to turn into that could survive in these elements. It wasn't that it wanted to, like, be a dog and sneak in with the other dogs.
How did it know that? How did it know about dogs?
Just, like, because, I don't know, it saw a dog running. I don't know. Like, in the book, there's an alien life form. The very beginning of the book is they're already doing the autopsy on the thing. And from there, it turns into a dog, and from there, it starts turning into people. But I do like, I would kind of like to watch it with that in mind, that notion of, is this thing literally just trying to survive? Does it have any kind of malice, or are these people just afraid of, you know? It's not that they shouldn't be afraid of it, like their bodies are being stolen by this crazy virus. But I do wonder what the movie looks like if you're watching it from the thing's perspective.
Well, it looks, yeah, like y'all are saying, it's funny to think about it like that because it's clearly going and killing these people in these brutal ways. But yeah, it's a non-judgmental movie in a weird way. It's just it just looks gross, and yeah, we have to kill this because it's killing us. It's worse. It's a survival of the fittest kind of thing about the thing. I mean, I love the convention of it begins with, you know, you see the last people that this whole charade just happened to,
and the last
survivor trying to kill the dog. So you know that this is just going to be a cycle and there's no end to it, basically, unless did they get it in that explosion?
If they can burn it all out, yeah.
We'll see.
There's a funny bit about that first scene. I've read that if you speak Norwegian, they spoil the entire movie when that guy gets out of the helicopter and starts yelling at everyone. He just explains everything.
The defibrillator scene's going to be awesome.
At the ending, Childs is really the one who is the thing. So it's gasoline, not whiskey. That's what he's. There is something interesting about the fact that, so it's a Norwegian crew versus this American crew. And Kurt Russell, with his American sort of exceptionalism and hubris, keeps calling them Swedes, right? So is Carpenter making a sort of like statement about American hubris? Like, you have these Norwegians that are like trying to save. They're trying to stop it. And of course, the arrogant Americans, because they are uncultured, they don't speak a language, they don't listen. And then, of course, they don't really like respect going out. I mean, maybe the scientist and the doctor do, but they don't really respect the findings of the Norwegians. And then all of a sudden it's Blair who's the one that starts like being like, no, you guys don't understand how serious this is. They understood it and they were trying to contain it. And so is there something,
one of the craziest?
Yeah, because there's also this opening, opening bit where, you know, when Kurt Russell says cheating bitch to this computer while he's drinking, it's like, what's up there? Like, he just doesn't trust reality. Is that the idea? And is this sort of like, what paranoia, what nationalism can induce in you as you refuse to look at the world as it is? I don't know.
One of the craziest parts, one of my favorite lines in the movie, I just think it's so funny, is when they recover all of the research materials from the Norwegian camp, and they're all huddled around the TV, and they see the footage of them excavating the thing and pulling it out of the ice. And then one of the guys goes, I'm not gonna stand around and watch this whole fucking thing. He says something like, I don't have time to watch this. I'm like, you don't have time. You've watched the same episode of Let's Make a Deal 1,000 times. All you have is time, and this seems pretty important.
It's pretty important.
To your point, it does seem like there is a certain arrogance surrounding that decision that, like, I'm not going to watch a bunch of Norwegian footage that explains my exact predicament. I'd rather just suss this thing out.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I'm pressing this kind of issue is because John Carpenter tweeted, I think in like 2017 or something like that, maybe 2018, that they Live is about yuppies and unfettered capitalism. So you know that this is a concern of his, right? You know that he is critiquing Reagan's America, as we talked about last week in Escape from New York. We know that he has been critical of those things and that there are themes that he's exploring. So what is there something similar going on here? Is he critiquing a sort of like American nationalism? Is he critiquing this like shift in empire in the world and how an empire can spread? Like, what is he critiquing? Like, oh, if we don't trust science, then it's going to kind of bite you in the ass because you don't trust the people that came before you. And even if they're, especially the Norwegians, because they're ahead of the game with their welfare state system or something like that, right? Like I don't know. Like I've read a couple pieces that were saying that this could be interpreted in some ways, of course, death of the author here, in relation to like climate change, right? And this thing that just kind of like ravages the world, and that it spreads endlessly and totally indiscriminately or something like that.
And there's nowhere to hide from it.
And that sort of thing. And so then it leads you with this like radical pessimism, like almost like a nihilism here. So is that something that's going on in this film? What exactly can we take away here? What is the meaning? Let's show them the meaning, Ryan.
I do think it's funny because this movie, as we've discussed just in our short conversation, is ripe with things you could potentially pull out with meaning, right? You know, like you could make climate change a one-to-one. And like AIDS, I was trying to make earlier.
The coronavirus.
The Red Scare. The coronavirus.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's obviously, just with the nature of the way the thing works and stuff, I can totally see John Carpenter making a commentary on xenophobia and stuff, just how like not trusting your neighbor and who am I trusting, even though I'm supposed to know this person, but do I really know them, and that kind of thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, in general terms, he's exploring how something can mimetically spread, and how if we don't know it, if we don't understand it, and if we don't take it seriously, then what it can do is it can lead to a process of like dehumanizing, suspicion, paranoia. You treat the other person as an other, right, or as an object.
Uh-huh.
And when that happens, that spreads unconsciously, and it spreads rapidly. Like, that's clearly, at the very least, the very general broad strokes, something he's exploring here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say it's funny because also, like you said at the very beginning, at the end of the day, this is just a cool monster movie in Antarctica, right? With insane special effects, so it absolutely works on that level without any politics involved and stuff. But yeah, it is fun to, you know, kind of see. He's always inserting political messages into his movies. So.
Synth McGee Poet just contributed to the chat. She says Carpenter faithfully adapted the novella, and that's something to take away from any sort of political read on this. That one of the things that struck me on reading it to prepare for the podcast is that in the very first chapter, that like the very first sentence, the first paragraph is all just describing the human detritus that is littered across Antarctica from their post. That it's all like about oil dripping and the smell of all of these like discarded rubbish that they've dispensed with in their research there. And you do get the sense that like there is something being said from the source material that this is there's a colonial aspect to it, almost, that like even the forest reaches of the earth are not safe from all of our fucking litter and stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. So in psychoanalysis, Freud popularizes a notion of what's das Ding in German, but it's the thing, right? And later psychoanalysts like Jacques Lacan have popularized this even more. And the difference is that when you talk about like word presentations, they take place at the level of consciousness or the subconscious. But the thing or thing presentations, they take place at the level of the unconscious, that which is completely unknowable, that which is completely beyond symbolization, that which is completely beyond language and even thought, right? And I feel like you kind of get something similar here. I mean, first of all, the film is called The Thing, and there's something about thingness, right? There's something about just calling something a thing by it being indescribable, by using this generic category. It seems to imply that this is something that is beyond description, something that is beyond our symbolic regime. So then what ends up happening is when you respond to that thing, you're always responding to it because it's a trauma, right? You're always responding to it as something that is scary, that is terrifying, and that only can reveal itself through patterns that are familiar to us, right? So that's why the humans are all like, oh, it's trying to get us, or it's trying to do this, and they have to ascribe agency to it because that's how they understand the world. But the thing itself, or we could say in like Kantian philosophical terms, the thing in itself, the really real, the true beyond all representations, is something that is forever outside of us. It is radically other. It is the otherness of the other. It is something that is completely beyond our capacities to
ultimately
grasp.
Ultimately unknowable.
Yeah, and I think it leads to then we can start thinking about cosmic horror, right? We could start thinking about that this is a
Lovecraftian sense.
In Lovecraftian stuff. That's right. This is a horror that is beyond what we can even imagine in our worlds that we construct here.
Well, there's
amen, brother.
Guillermo del Toro, who's one of my favorite filmmakers, who works a lot in creature features and stuff, is very inspired by Lovecraft, and he once again, I think you kind of laughed when Austin brought up John Carpenter tweeting, Ryan. But it is so great to have all these wonderful filmmakers just have their brain attached to the internet, so you can always kind of like stream through and just see if they've dropped any nuggets of wisdom. And Guillermo del Toro's Twitter is all just his thoughts on movies, his thoughts on creatures as an abstract concept, his thoughts on specific creatures from past movies. And he's very fond of reminding his fans and followers that all of the most insane creatures you can imagine, whatever makes it into the worlds of fiction, those things are still drawn from a totally terrestrial understanding of biology. So we are still, no matter, in the makeup, the sculpting, the prosthetics in this are amazing. Rob Bottin's a fucking genius. He was 22 years old when he made this movie. Just
the
like
fuck?
Prodigiously gifted artist. But in spite of his intense creative capacity, even someone like him is still going to be sort of lashed to the notion of what we perceive as a life form. You know, it may have extra eyes and legs and all kinds of claws and unfurling mouths that stretch out with all the dog teeth in the middle, like some incredible work in this, but it is still one of those things that we really can't imagine what life would look like beyond our atmosphere.
But isn't that because
it would evolve in a totally different way?
Isn't that because, though, that even when the thing, quote, bursts out of another organism as its host, it's already begun cell replication? So
yeah,
actually,
it's beginning to imitate it.
So what we're seeing is already an imitation of the forms that it has inhabited. So this is what I wonder. Even the alien spacecraft, what if the alien spacecraft was simply another host body, not the thing flying the spaceship? So what you have with the thing is actually something that is totally almost mystical. It is something that maybe doesn't have a body. Maybe it is something that is completely disembodied in the sense that because we only understand...
It might just be microscopic. Yeah.
It might even be something more fundamental than that. Something more indescribable than that. Because even that is something that exists. Now, maybe it would still have to exist within the physical laws of the universe, but because it's a material entity. But there's something that seems that we don't even see the thing, actually. All we ever see are imitations of human or earthly bodies. Of
that's
the thing's
something
replication.
They,
yeah.
That the author explicitly addresses in the novella, that they, when they pull it out and start picking it apart, they're like, it's not like anything I've ever seen. And they're like, we don't even know if this is what it looked like at the beginning. It's and they say that one of the aliens it turns into to fight the dogs, they're like, well, why would it turn into that? And they're probably like, and they one of them just says, oh, it probably met that alien in its travels and thought it was a badass. Like, it just it is that. I do like that notion. I like that read of the film, that it's almost just really more adaptive and utilitarian than malicious. And that it just, like, it's almost like an animal. When backed into a corner, it will just put on its scariest skin. It will puff itself up and try to create a sense of danger. Absolutely. I really do like that notion. It really gets your head turning about what the possibilities for this are.
Yeah. Ryan, do you think this is the greatest horror film ever made?
It's a great question, Austin. I was going to ask you guys that. I think it's up there. Top five for show. I don't know the greatest horror movie. Like if you asked probably 50 people on the street, I know it's well known, especially to cinephiles. But
yeah, it is a little under the radar, person, huh? Yeah.
Your average everyday person, I don't feel like really like knows and loves the thing and thinks about that as the ultimate horror movie. But is that what the ultimate horror movie is? Do you need all
the popular masses? I feel like they would say Exorcist. The Exorcist is the one.
Yeah, they'd say, or Halloween, another Carpenter movie, I'd say would be up there. I don't know if that holds up as the greatest horror movie. You know, it depends on our metrics here. A lot goes into what is the best horror movie. You can't just ask me that.
It's their own. But I think more and more people are coming to this movie and rediscovering it. Not just that they haven't seen it before, absolutely, but are rediscovering an appreciation for it. And the conversation surrounding this movie, it went from being a total box office flop that, you know, almost stalled out John Carpenter's career, to now it's widely regarded, I would say, at least by folks who care enough to discuss horror movies, it's widely regarded as one of the best horror movies, and I can't disagree.
And just best horror movies, best use of practical effects, and talking about how much it flopped, that really pissed off John Carpenter, apparently, and, you know, because he was like, this is my best movie, why did it flop so hard, which would... You know, I'd feel bad if I made The Thing and no one went and saw it. I'm like, what the fuck? What else do I got to do? Are you kidding me? I lost my train of thought. What were we just talking
about? Best horror film in the world?
Sorry. Oh, we're live. We're not live, are we? Best horror movie. I love how The Thing is whenever people are talking about practical effects and why we should go back to them, this is the ultimate example of that. This is like people say, well, you know, it could be as, you know, look at The Thing, right? That's what you can do. This is the landmarks practical effects scary movie, and why you would ever fight to make practical over digital is you would look at a movie like The Thing and say, this is what can be done. So I think if for anything else, you know, that this is a huge movie.
Let's do this in the chat right now. Just give us either a Cronenberg or a Carpenter. Who is the master of body horror? Just in the chat, all you have to write
a body horror. Well, Cronenberg is a body horror, but
is this is body horror too, right? Like that's essentially.
Yeah, but Cronenberg took six swings at that bat, whereas John Carpenter made one body horror for career. Every single Cronenberg movie.
Big Trouble has some body horror elements too. Right?
Yeah, but it's not defined by that the way that, like, you know, Naked Lunch, Videodrome, The Fly, Dead Ringers has some really gross aspects to it. Crash, absolutely. Shivers, Rabid, baby growing out of her stomach in that movie is just
insane.
In
terms of a genre that he's been consistent, he's the guy that is kind of most associated with it. But who does it better? Like, I'll be honest, in terms of like using...
Cronenberg.
You think Cronenberg does? Or do you think that something like...
Overall.
Overall. So you don't think...
I mean, obviously,
you don't think
the
that
thing,
the quality of the thing gives him such...
I think...
clout.
The Thing is I love David Cronenberg, but I think The Thing is a better movie than any David Cronenberg movie. But, I mean, you're weighing... one masterpiece versus like six or seven, also many of the masterpieces, just not quite as good as The Thing. Like,
so is The Thing good enough to unseat all of those other
No, I think Carpenter,
third place finishes.
Carpenter might be the horror master, but David Cronenberg's the body horror master. He's got his little fiefdom, but Carpenter's the king. We all love Carpenter.
Well, and especially in terms of body horror, like I really need to be freaked out for a sustained period of time, and the reaching into the belly and getting the VHS tape and Videodrome, the fly makeup
Existence,
and stuff,
which is Videodrome
with the
with
arm
video
gun.
Games.
It's just like he has so many examples of these kind of effects that really are effective and work. And the thing is, as much as I love The Thing, and I do think that narratively it works better, he uses the practical effects in service of an amazing story better than I think Cronenberg does, who I think kind of dwells and really kind of leans into and is, what is it?
He kind of
indulgent
in it a little bit.
He's indulgent
in
it.
He loves to get grimy.
Yeah, and I love that about him, but it's just different strokes for different folks here. John Carpenter's a way more populist filmmaker is trying to tell a more accessible story. David Cronenberg is a freak. And, so that's why I think he's the more of the master of body horror.
Okay, now before we go, we have to talk about the ending, just because this is something that everybody freaking talks about. So Ryan, what do you think is going on at the end? What is your interpretation?
I think somebody is the Thing.
I think the Thing
is about to go.
So it's one of
find
them.
I think that's my interpretation, is that it's not a happy ending, and that we're supposed to think that probably the Thing is either there or still alive in the wreckage, or one of them, and it's on, and this is just going to repeat itself until the world is fucking fucked.
Okay. I think the ending's perfect, and if you like the fun ambiguity of it, more power to you. But if you don't like fun, Dean Cundey, the film cinematographer, actually said in an interview, he kind of tipped his hand and he revealed who may or may not be the Thing at the end of it. I won't spoil it on the podcast, but if you want to check it out, you can look it up. It's pretty.
Well,
This is what he said.
He said that they used a trick of lighting to basically reveal who was human and who was not human at any given time. But a lot of people have used this trick of lighting to try to analyze the ending. And while they do come firmly down on one side, it is definitely inconclusive, because I've watched it on a phone, I've watched it on an iPad, and I've watched it on like a big screen to try to because I've known about this for years, because I've known about this ending ambiguity, and I've been curious about it. And I still am like, really? Because everybody basically assumes that it's one of the two based on this trick that the DP reveals, right? But I don't know I don't know if it's that obvious.
Well,
and who do you think it is?
I agree with Games You Love in the chat. He says, I don't think either of them is the Thing. I don't necessarily agree with that part. But the second part here, that's not the point of the ending, they say. So I would agree with that, Games You Love. The point of the ending is not who is or isn't the Thing. The point is that neither one of them can know for sure. Like, that's the scary thing about it.
Yeah. And it is fun that I think it's fun that people have all these fan theories, not because I think it's important to nail down so that we know the answer, but I think it's fun to have this debate, because you're like, ooh, it could be this, or it could be both, or it could be neither, or it doesn't matter, because then they're going to freeze to death. But nevertheless, maybe there's other things out there in the universe, and maybe there's this like fucking multiverse filled with this virus that is just spreading and it's inevitable for it to come back, or maybe the rescue crew will come and then the Thing will jump on the rescue crew and it'll get back in there and it'll secretly get back to the United States or something like that, or get back to Europe and start. I mean, who knows? The thing that's interesting is I think it's fun when you have an ambiguous ending like this, because then people have something to talk about over beers at a bar, right?
Yeah.
So that's why it's great.
One more thing to talk about, and we mentioned it up top, but the best form that the Thing takes is that dog at the beginning of the movie. And I watched the behind-the-scenes featurette for this one, and apparently that dog is half husky, half wolf. And it wasn't very well trained, because it's a wild animal. And the trainer had to tell all the actors, hey, if he's, like, mad at you, or if he's if he's feeling aggressive, he won't bark or snap or anything, but he'll just kind of like sort of settle down and get this look in his eyes. So if you see that look, just no one make any sudden movements. Like, they literally just had a wild animal on set that they were just sort of flying by the seat of their pants with regards to how they would handle it. Like, it was trained with regards to hitting marks and stuff, but at the end of the day, it still had this killer instinct. And just reading about that and watching the movie in that context, and my God, that dog is just so compelling when it's on screen. The way that they get some of those reaction shots, and you see the look that they're alluding to in the behind the scenes featurette, like when he's just, you know, kind of pacing down the hallway and he's sort of hunched over and he's like getting low to the ground, like he's about to pounce at any moment. It's just like, it's great. And some of those reaction shots of him looking out the window, I have seen great actors give worse performances than this dog.
I'm telling you. I tweeted out that the second best performance in the film behind Uncle Kurt is that dog. And that isn't to shit on the other actors, but it's because that dog is fucking awesome. It's compelling.
That dog's so good. Yeah.
I know. Okay.
Rest in peace, Jed, the dog from The Thing.
Let us jump into some mailbag and question stuff. So we've wrapped up Carpenter. Those are the four films that we're going to do now. That doesn't mean we'll never talk about Carpenter again. I'm sure we will revisit. We've gotten lots of requests for other Carpenter films. You know, so who knows if we'll be able to come back at a particular time. The plan is to do Halloween at October, so hopefully we can. But this has been great. So if you guys want us to do other sort of engagements of particular directors too, you can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. Maybe we'll do a Patreon poll too for something like this, where we list a director and then maybe just do another kind of month. Yeah, that'd be kind of cool. But anyway, let's first jump into the voicemail section. If you have a comment or question or a film request or anything like that, please, you can definitely call us in at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. First, let's start off with Fox Metro, who wants to talk about Ferris Bueller.
Hey, Weisenheimers, it's Fox Metro. I noticed in the Ferris Bueller episode you got going on, how you went into John Hughes talking about, like, oh, yeah, he gets tossed out a window and all these crazy things. And it just brought me back to, like, thinking on, like, TV show plots where they, like, jam all kinds of crazy things in, and it's more or less just to see what they can get away with, where they can have a prickly thorn to shave down maybe. And I'm like wondering, does John Hughes just like have a lot of crazy ideas that he just throws in with the kitchen sink and he's just like, let's work back from there? Or is that like a common practice, you think? Like, what's going on with like some of these writers?
Yeah, what is going on with some of these writers, Ryan?
With some of these writers.
Well, what specifically is he, like, sequence or something, or movie is he referring to where John Hughes threw in? Oh, I guess Ferris Bueller, because there's all these random scenes. Is that the idea?
I mean, I think so, yeah. That was kind of my interpretation of the VM.
Or we mentioned Bueller that there was a deleted scene or a scene in the script that maybe never got filmed where Cameron's dad comes home and throws him out the window or something like that. I can't remember 100%.
I mean, I love John Hughes, and I've been actually watching a lot of interviews with him lately, and he's an interesting dude. And I think that movie was totally just like what you guys might have talked about this, but obviously, based on some dude in his high school that he wanted to be like, right? And he always saw him as himself, the cool dude he always wanted to be like, the Tyler Durden character, if you will. And then he always was the Cameron. And I think it's just as much as just thinking about all the hijinks you could come up with in one day if you had the perfect day off. I mean, to me, it's not that too zany. I mean, it is zany, but it's not like too zany.
Yeah.
Do you guys think it's too zany? Too much?
Yeah, what do you think, Raymond?
I'm not crazy about Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I think it has its charms.
So what?
On the zaniness scale, no, I would say it's not too zany.
Now, what is zany? He also wrote Baby's Day Out, I want to say.
Now, that's a zany picture.
Now, that is Ferris Bueller's Day Out with a baby, basically. And that's basically just a Three Stooges movie come to life.
Okay, cool. Let's jump into the next voicemail. It is from Anonymous, who has a thought on Escape from New York and also a sort of suggestion about Japanese films in the future. So, go ahead, Anon.
Nice.
Hey, guys. Long-time fan of the show. I'm calling about that last episode you guys did on Escape from New York, and I was wondering, I think Austin mentioned it being like a prototype of Western. I was thinking after rewatching it for the first time since I was 10, it's kind of like a samurai flick. I thought it was kind of like more of a Yojimbo type thing. It was kind of going for maybe more than the samurai, where it's kind of an anti-hero who lives by his own code that's kind of entrenched. So, yeah, that plus I was wondering if you guys are ever going to review maybe any like Kurosawa or any other Japanese movies. Big fan. Thanks.
Funny enough, he mentions that we talked about how this was kind of Escape from New York was kind of his Sergio Leone movie, whereas Assault on Precinct 13 is kind of his Howard Hawks takeoff of the Western. But Fistful of Dollars, the first Man with No Name movie with Clint Eastwood, was actually a remake of Yojimbo. So kind of funny that he brings that up. So there's a long history of Japanese and American cinema kind of stealing from each other and overlapping. And right. if you want to really go down the rabbit hole, if you watch Yojimbo, then you watch Django starring Franco Nero, directed by Sergio Corbucci, then you watch Takashi Miike's Sukiyaki Western Django, you'll see like a Western infused samurai movie that's a remake of a samurai infused Western movie. and then that is also a remake of just Yojimbo. So it's like there's so many layers of filmmakers always stealing from each other and taking their inspirations and throwing them on the screen. And I for one, would love to do some Japanese cinema on the podcast.
And Kurosawa himself, you know, there's the whole Seven Samurai that then got remade into The Magnificent Seven, the Western film. So I feel like that happened a lot back in the day.
And also, weren't some of the samurai films from Kurosawa, weren't they also explicitly already influenced by previous Westerns that had been made in like the 40s? So again, the influence of, you know,
Chicken and the Egg.
That's right, exactly, right?
Filmmakers are always stealing from each other, and I love it.
I hate it. It should be illegal.
Okay, let's jump into the email portion of the mailbag now. If you want, like I said, you can call us or you can email us. If you want to email us, it's movies@wisecrack.co. The first email that I'm going to jump into is from Mike. Where is it? Oh, hold on one second. Let me get this here. Sorry. Okay, Mike, who... basically, it's a thought on kind of that was inspired by Escape from New York, but kind of goes into a different direction that also talks about climax and things like that. So when you mentioned discussing Gaspar Noé's films, Climax, Enter the Void in particular, I immediately hoped that if or when this occurs, you might delve into when, why, and how psychedelic and surrealist films work as transcendentalist or philosophically and artistically deep versus when they merely appropriate a style in a shallow attempt at reaching stoned viewers. I personally love the stylized insanity of Amer and The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, despite my qualms with certain aspects of each, but barely connected with the third film helmed by Alain Cate and Bruno Forzini's
Let the Corpses Tan.
When I was in a bad mood, was I in a bad mood? Did I expect something else, or did they call it in, or all three of these possibilities simultaneously and equally valid? So basically the question is this, is like, I guess... what is it that makes a psychedelic film philosophically interesting or deep versus some kind of film that's just trying to shock or just trying to do something wild? And would something like Enter the Void be interesting, philosophically deep, thematically rich? Or is it kind of just like a sort of like, ooh, that's a cool stoner movie, maybe just like a glammed up version of, I don't know, some freaking Cheech and Chong film or something like that, a prestige version of a stoner film?
I think I get what they're saying, but... I think there's some stoner movies, quote unquote, that have lots to say. And I think Enter the Void is one of them. But it kind of like the thing, how you said at the beginning of this podcast, where like, yeah, there's all this stuff going on and you can get into what it's saying, but also it works on the level of straight horror monster movie. I feel like your average stoner movie, it's like, yeah, If you're lucky, there's something to say. You can read into it, usually about, you know, the state of mind and consciousness and whatever, and perception. But also, the base level is, at the end of the day, you'll just have some pretty shit to look at that's usually weird and cool. And, you know, that's usually what's at the base level of any stoner movie is there's going to be some psychedelic scene or some sort of colorful, subjective imagery going on, which usually I think is unsuccessful in movies. It's so hard to get an actual, like, tripping scene done well, or even people being high. I think what works usually, to me, that works the best to show people being high is literally just not showing the subjectivity at all. Just showing a person laughing their ass off is usually what it looks like in reality, and I think is more truthful to the moment, but then somehow expressing what they're going through in their head a different way. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
You know, I don't necessarily know that I would, if we're saying like all psychedelia is going hand in hand with, you know, quote unquote stoner movies, because the movies he alluded to in his email, or he or she, they alluded to Bruno Forzani and Helene Catet's films. I do understand the criticism of those pictures. I share it sometimes. And I think they have a short film in one of the ABCs of Death anthologies that's about 5 minutes long, but is just like pure candy colored style on style. And it's just, there's no dialogue. It's just like all composition and sound mix. And it really, really works for 5 minutes. But then when you stretch that out to an hour and a half, you know, you really got to be in the mood for it. You have to be on that wavelength. I think another recent example of that is if you've seen Anna Biller's The Love Witch, which is kind of in a similar stylistic vein as a lot of Stephanie Rothman's works, particularly The Velvet Vampire and stuff. I really like those movies when I'm in the mood for them. But if I'm not in the mood for them, you can't beat it out of me. Like a lot of the time. And maybe I've never smoked weed, so maybe that would help me get through some of those more like
highly recommended
style over substance. But sometimes you do get movies that come in that are like a clear homage to giallo films, whether it's Bruno Forzani and Helene Catet or someone like Peter Strickland, and their movies are so much just about style over style and replicating a mood, and sometimes I can't get into that.
Okay.
I think Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is a good example of kind of a movie that has psychedelic elements, but is also has a ton to say and a voice and has good freak out psychedelic scenes or whatever have you.
That's a movie I think you could safely hit with the stoner stamp.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a total stoner movie.
Okay, so we can't keep going down further into the questions and things like that today, but I do want to just do one last final one. It was somebody who wrote in, Jason, talking about maybe possibly doing PTA's The Master in the future. Now, we did There Will Be Blood, but there's obviously lots within PTA's filmography that we could explore. Let me just ask you this. If you were going to do one other PTA film, what would it be?
Have we done Boogie Nights? I mean, that's my.
I knew I could count on Ryan to bring out Boogie Nights. I didn't have to waste my vote.
It's obviously his masterpiece. Yeah, I mean, that would be my pick.
Mine would be Phantom Thread. It's Paul Thomas Anderson's my favorite filmmaker, and I adore Phantom Thread. And I think that he's just really been in the pocket for the last few films. I mean, I think all of his movies have their merits. I really like Inherent Vice. I really like Inherent Vice. But that that brings up an interesting question we may want to end on. That the four John Carpenter films that we covered this month are all from a miraculous 8-film stretch. I think kind of miraculous. From The Fog to They Live. Some are better than others, but I think they're all pretty solid. I would say sound off in the comments or hit us up on Twitter. Send us an email. Let us know what you think the best filmmaking streaks like that of all time are. Because I think Paul Thomas Anderson is still playing a hot hand. He's been on
Coppola
fire for a
there
while.
In the middle of the seven. You know, you had like The Conversation, Godfather, Apocalypse Now, Godfather 2, amongst a couple others. That's a famous streak.
I'm curious what some of our listeners might think. Who are some of your favorite filmmakers? What are some of their best movies? Who has had the longest winning streak in film history?
That is a great question. All right, we'll leave it on that note. Where can people find you on the internet, Raymond, so they can debate with you about these streaks and the best filmmakers out there? Yeah.
You can hit me up on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. That's CREAMATORIA. Always happy to talk movies.
And Ryan?
And actually, mine you can find on Raymond's over there. It's at Ryan's Game Show. On Twitter and
it's right here
on YouTube, and and Ryan Shorts. I'm going to release a video with a Memphis legend either this week or next week. I can't wait.
Did you bring Robert Johnson back from the dead?
I did not. He's a Mississippi legend. One of my last
Mississippi. Sorry.
Him.
Yeah.
No, I know. That's why I was going to say. Did you go to the crossroads and dig him up?
No.
Awesome. Yeah, and if you want to hit me up, you can find me on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. You can hit me up on Insta, AUS_HAY. That's it, folks. Carpenter, that's the wrap on our retrospective. We will be back with our next film, which will be the patron-chosen film, which was Hook. So make sure y'all watch Hook. It won't be next week. It will be the week after. We're going to take a little bit of a break next week, but we're coming back hot with the film that y'all chose. That was Ryan's suggestion, so that's what we're coming back to. All right, Ryan, send us out, brother.
And if you want to vote in future Patreon polls, patreon.com/wisecrack.
And always vote for my pick, please. Just like you did this time. I really appreciate it, fans. You got this for me. All right, here we go.
Goodbye, live from Antarctica. This has been Show Me the Meat.